Film Spotting is presented by PeerFlix. Trade DVDs online at peerflix.com/filmspotting.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Sam Van Halgren. There are 145 movies playing at the Chicago International Film Festival. On tonight's show, we'll discuss three of them: A Guide to Recognizing Your Saints and Wrist Cutters, A Love Story, both feature film directing debuts, and Barbara Kopple's new Dixie Chicks documentary, Shut Up and Sing.
Plus, Massacre Theater and an interview with actor-turned-director D.B. Sweeney. And we'll also have our top five movies about starting over. But, Sam, let's start with A Guide to Recognizing Your Saints, a film that won Best Director and Best Ensemble at the 2006 Sundance Film Festival. It's currently playing in New York and L.A. with an expanded release scheduled for later this fall.
Anyway, Giuseppe, he's going to be dead. Yeah, I know. Sucks. There'll be another guy you'll meet, too. Same with him. And then another little boy. He's going to die, too. What a mess, huh? And I don't even know why I feel like I got to tell you this up front, but I do. And don't worry, Mike. I'm not giving away any big ending, you know.
That's Robert Downey Jr. as Ditto Montiel, a scene early in Ditto Montiel's A Guide to Recognizing Your Saints. In interviews, first-time writer-director Montiel explains that despite the fact that his film is based on his own memoir of the same name and the central character bears his name, the film is not a true biography. According to Montiel, the goal of the film is to evoke a feeling of a time and place. And that time and place is the particularly rough neighborhood in Astoria, Queens, circa 1986, where Montiel came of age. Adam, this movie belongs to a certain tradition, young guys growing up on New York's mean streets, kids do the right thing, Saturday Night Fever. And in interviews, Montiel references more recent films as well, like Raising Victor Vargas and Requiem for a Dream. How does A Guide to Recognizing Your Saints measure up to its peers?
Well, I know that you love the fact that he's referencing Raising Victor Vargas.
Oh, favorite film of mine.
You love that film, so yeah. That had to make you feel at ease a little bit. Honestly, I have to say, I think this film is right up there. Another film I thought about is A Bronx Tale with Chaz Palminteri in a completely different role. In A Bronx Tale, he's the mobster who's always in control. He's certainly becomes a father figure, but here he is the father, and he's the one having the contentious relationship with his son, Ditto, played by Robert Downey Jr., or the young Ditto is Shia LaBeouf. They're both very good in this film. Certainly I thought of Kids. Certainly I thought of Mean Streets. And as blasphemous as it sounds, I think Montiel is probably just as successful at evoking that spirit of the neighborhood that you mentioned in your intro as Scorsese is. I know it's crazy, but I really do think he's got something here. And I think you really do have to frame this movie in a discussion, within a discussion, of other movies, because that's what Montiel has very clearly done with it. There are these Brechtian moments throughout where characters reveal that they know they're in a film. There's a great montage of personal moments for each character where they come right up to the camera and say who they are.
Trouble.
Oh, yeah. Great music there. Montiel's dialogue at the beginning that we played, he tells you two of these people are going to die. He's letting you know that up front. And there are moments where the screenplay actually appears on screen throughout the movie where characters are saying dialogue and it appears as white text over black and it looks like it's in screenplay form. At first, I thought it was just arty, and then I got it, or on some level it made sense to me. And I think, first of all, it has to do with the nature of memory. I think an argument can be made that in this day and age, at least, we play out our memories, really, in a certain cinematic form in our head. But really, I think Montiel is hyper-aware that we have seen this all before. It goes back to that intro, too, saying these guys are going to die. I'm just going to tell you it right off the bat. We've seen this all before. He's hyper-aware of how these characters are going to seem like types. The mentally challenged brother, the thug Italian kid with an abusive father, the slightly off goofy friend, Nerf, of course, even has the funny name to go with it. But the thing is, Sam, they are real. They're real from his experiences. And to make it work, I think he realized that he has to embrace that artifice. And really, by doing so, for me, he made a film that for me actually felt way more authentic. And I hate to continue beating this film a little bit, but it actually feels more authentic.
What you
to
say
me.
About Half Nelson?
Yeah, feels more authentic by embracing that artifice than a film that is more straightforward but also gritty, Half Nelson. So I was really impressed with this first-time film.
Well, you answered the question that I think I had, was does the artifice work? And for me, I never thought quite that it did. And I agree. I think it had a lot to do with how do I put memory on screen in terms of how we perceive memory, how we remember things. And I think there was absolutely an attempt to do that through all the means you already mentioned. And I kept wondering how it was supposed to help me offer some insight into characters' motivations.
Mm-hmm.
And I frequently, and I think maybe you were having the same frustration at the beginning that I was, that I felt like it was actually distracting from some really, really powerful scenes and didn't necessarily add up to it. I think, and whether I just got used to it like you did, or there's just less of it as the movie plays out, and I think there is. I think, you know, it became less bothersome. This movie is really powerful, really well acted, but for me, I think it worked in scenes and doesn't necessarily work as a whole. I can't say enough about the cast. Chaz Palminteri, like you said, I mean, it's brilliant casting in a way because you keep expecting him to blow his top.
Mm-hmm.
It's Chaz Palminteri, for God's sake. And so what's unique about this story, I think, is the relationship that's new in terms of, you know, Shia LaBeouf being, you know, this character that will grow up and leave the neighborhood. I think that Ditto Montiel knows all these characters really well, whether they're composites or not. Parents, obviously, the friends. But I'm not convinced that he really knew enough about himself to put himself on screen. Shia LaBeouf is incredible in this film, really
mm-hmm.
powerful presence. But I never felt completely sure that I understood his motivations.
Hmm.
And I just felt like there was this fuzziness at the center of the picture, that some scenes that Shia LaBeouf had between other characters, I understood what he was getting at, but I never felt like it came into really sharp focus.
Okay,
again,
no.
I really admired it, really liked the acting. Some scenes are incredibly powerful, but I still felt like it hadn't quite figured itself out.
Okay, well, I think that's a really great point, and I agree with it, except that for me, it's not a flaw of the film. I think that there's a simple fact that he does understand his friends better than he does himself, or at least, of course, he thinks he does. But this film is a way of him trying to work out his own issues. And so the fact that he is kind of struggling, I agree with you that Shia LaBeouf seems less realized in many ways than some of the supporting characters do. I will give you that. But again, for me, that actually works and kind of fits in with the whole thing that I think he's trying to do. I agree with you. I loved all the acting. I even really liked, I thought he was amazingly tough and yet vulnerable. Channing Tatum Antonio, this, you know, again, kind of the thug kid, but really there's a core there that's really hard to get yourself around. And, you know, you mentioned early on whether or not some of the technique of it was distracting. And I think that's probably true, but for me, it was distracting, but exciting. I was willing to go along with it just because I felt like I was seeing some things, even just the opening shot of Diane Wiest, who's very good as well,
yeah,
playing his mom. There's this interesting glow about the way it's shot, the cinematography and just the framing of it and her discussion and the fact that it doesn't cut. I'm not used to seeing this in an independent film, certainly. You're used to seeing films that are more like Half Nelson, try to be a little more kind of, you know, documentary style, more vigorous with a handheld camera. This felt really deliberate, and in a way that just really excited me. And I'll say too that after I saw it, I went to Rotten Tomatoes just to see, you know, is anybody reviewing this, and did anybody express kind of what I had, my reaction to it? And A.O. Scott, they have a great line from A.O. Scott on there where he says that it's so full of life and feeling that the screen can hardly contain it. And honestly, I felt a little bit like that. Even though some scenes, maybe as a whole it doesn't work as well as individual scenes, you're saying maybe its parts are better than the sum.
Right.
But still, watching those parts, for me, I was always kind of on edge with the technique of it and just also the writing and the way the dialogue is constantly overlapping. It felt so real to me. And the intensity of just their discussions in their kitchen, it had me on edge my whole time. I know for a fact that it got my heart rate pumping watching the film. And so for that alone, I have to recommend that people see this film if they get a chance.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you are recommending it because I do recommend it too, maybe not as vigorously. And I think for me, it's like, at the beginning, I certainly felt like he didn't trust the power of the scenes enough. And I felt like he was disrupting my experience, my emotional experience, with some creative post-production in some way. But absolutely, I recommend it too.
Yeah, no, I think that post-production stuff that you mentioned, I think just matches what overall he's trying to do. And he recognizes the problem of trying to tell an autobiography anymore, really, because we have been down this road so many times. So it's interesting. I saw an interview with him where he said that Spike Lee's his favorite filmmaker and that he loves Spike Lee's craft, even if he doesn't like the film. I think people could have a similar reaction to this film. And of course, this film feels like Do the Right Thing in a lot of parts, and also like 25th Hour, a film I appreciate more than you, but actually Ditto Montiel says is one of his all-time favorite movies. So again, if you're a Spike Lee fan and you want to see something kind of new and different, I think you got to check out this movie.
I think you're right. I mean, it's bringing up Spike Lee, you actually can't you can't watch this without thinking of Spike Lee in terms of how Spike Lee brings that sort of artificial sense of memory and of just a perception of a time, evoking a time and a place.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Love in the Afterlife and the Dixie Chicks. More from the Chicago International Film Festival when we return.
Hello, podcast listeners. We hope you're enjoying the Chicago Film Fest edition of the show. We wanted to announce this week's PeerFlix DVD giveaway winner. Maggie Hart from Littleton, Colorado will receive Robert Altman's A Prairie Home Companion. Congrats, Maggie. Sign up for a free PeerFlix account now by going to peerflix.com/filmspotting or filmspotting.net, and you'll be entered to win Warren Beatty's Reds, the 25th Anniversary Edition, a movie Sam recently wrote about in The Dope Sheet, our weekly email newsletter. Also out on DVD this week, the 2006 version of The Omen, American Dreams, and The Breakup, one of our favorite movies of the summer. Welcome back to Film Spotting with Sam Van Hallgren. I'm Adam Kempinar. You can listen to Film Spotting right here on Chicago Public Radio the last Saturday of every month. Obviously, this is a special case, a bonus edition of Film Spotting tying in with the Film Fest. But we will be back on Saturday, October 28th with our regular show, reviews of The Prestige and Little Children. And we'll also get a chance to talk with the writer-director of Little Children, also in the bedroom, Todd Field. So look for that on Saturday, October 28th. And if you can't wait until the 28th for another fix of Film Spotting, the show is available as a weekly podcast. You can learn more and subscribe at filmspotting.net.
Tonight's show is devoted to the 42nd Annual Chicago International Film Festival. We're taking a look at three films playing at this year's festival, and later in the show, we'll have a conversation with actor and first-time director, D.B. Sweeney. But now, Barbara Kopple's latest documentary, Dixie Chicks, Shut Up and Sing.
Like, I would like to say that my comment was made
in reference to
the disappointment I feel, or the something I feel.
Frustration.
The frustration I feel as an American citizen for being ignored.
All right. So, I mean, I don't think that we should shy away from controversy. I mean, wouldn't it be great if we could get them, like, burning CDs and banning you from the radio?
That's the Dixie Chicks, Natalie Maines, Marty McGuire, and Emily Robeson, along with manager Simon Renshaw, dealing with the immediate aftermath of Maines' infamous 2003 comment, "Just so you know, we're ashamed the President of the United States is from Texas." It all seems pretty harmless now, but the outrage it sparked as the U.S. invaded Iraq provided ample material for Barbara Kopple's Shut Up and Sing. And this is a movie, Sam, that for us comes at a very serendipitous time. On our podcast, we're in the middle of a documentaries marathon where we're watching six classic documentaries we've always wanted to see. The second film in our marathon was a Barbara Kopple movie, her debut, Harlan County, USA, and we kicked off the marathon with D.A. Pennebaker's classic Bob Dylan chronicle, Don't Look Back. You can't help but think about Don't Look Back when watching Shut Up and Sing. Both follow musicians on the road, on the brink of great artistic change. Both docs even begin in London, which is where the Chicks were performing when Maines spoke out. You love Don't Look Back. Does Shut Up and Sing belong anywhere in the same nonfiction pantheon?
Well, I'd say not quite, but I think it is a very good documentary. It's surprising, it's moving, it's entertaining, and I think it's definitely worth tracking down. It'll be released in selected cities anyway later this fall. And it's funny, it's not something I would have said about the film, any of those things, about halfway through, when at that point I think I was ready really to chalk it up as an ambitious episode of Behind the Music or something. And I think what really makes this film work, and you realize how smart Koppel is as a filmmaker, is how it's constructed. And what Koppel does is takes us back and forth in time, between 2003 and the immediate aftermath of Maine's comments, and then late 2005 and early 2006 when they were recording the album that was just released a couple months ago. First of all, the Dixie Chicks are not Bob Dylan. I mean, they're very, very talented, and you actually see wonderfully how talented they are over the course of the film. But, you know, they haven't made the impact on music, of course, that Dylan has. And in fact, Natalie Maines says as much. They couldn't even help evoke Bob Dylan
and
in the course of the film. And Springsteen. You know, but part of Dylan's persona, particularly at that time when Don't Look Back was filmed, late 60s, part of his persona was as an anti-war spokesperson. I mean, he wrote probably the angriest anti-war song of all time, Masters of War.
Yeah, he never wanted to take credit for it,
right,
though, with the
press.
No,
which is interesting. He didn't have to. He let his music speak for it. But Maines, and then by proxy, the rest of the Dixie Chicks, only became political and anti-war spokespeople by accident. And I think that's the huge difference here. You know, right there you have the difference between somebody that's trying to make something happen and compared to somebody that something happened to them, really. Mm-hmm. And at first I was kind of frustrated by the fact that, you know, I was like, is this our Dylan? Is this, do we have the Dixie Chicks? And, you know, in the late 60s, they had Dylan. And because when put into a position to defend what she said, it's funny, Maines can't do it. In fact, she's most articulate on stage. And by the end of it, I came to appreciate that fact.
Right.
But I ended up thinking of Koppel's first documentary, like you said, Harlan County, USA. We were talking when we discussed Harlan County, USA, how incredibly articulate everyone is.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, they were much more articulate than any of the Dixie Chicks.
It's true.
In terms of talking about the war. But then I realized, of course, no, Koppel isn't trying to make the Dixie Chicks out to be the Dylan of our time. And really, what she's made is just a really wonderful documentary about the impact that Maines' comments had on the band and on their families. And I think with the film's construction, she makes this really moving and powerful document that's just made more compelling, I think, by the context, the war, the media, and ultimately how the war progresses between 2003 and 2006.
Yeah.
And I don't want to give it away, but the final scene is just had my fist in my mouth, honestly.
Yeah.
I think we talked about this. It's such a surprising thing to see. And then you realize it's a really amazing kind of poetic cyclical.
Yeah, it
thing.
Is. Yeah. I mean, Natalie Maines gets a chance to be back in the exact same situation where this all started, same club in London,
right,
about 2.5 years later or whatever. And, you know, everyone's wondering what she's going to say. And she says something that, you're right, is shocking in that we've just watched a 2-hour movie, an hour and a half movie, all about the fallout of that statement. And
right,
then we see what she does there. And in a way, it's shocking. And then you're right. You realize that it had to be that way almost, because it does match kind of what the film's dealing with. And you're right. It's a document about these people going through this change. But of course, it is a meditation in a way on free speech and just how free it is. And I think, you know, going back to that original question, Don't Look Back probably deserves more credit simply for being groundbreaking for what it was at the time. Koppel here isn't doing anything truly or really innovative in terms
visually,
of her style, other than maybe the way she goes between time, the way she cuts between 2003 and 2005. And it's not as shocking on some level or as emotional as Harlan County, but the subject matter is completely different, dealing with this mine worker strike and the depravity of the way some of these people are living. You know, watching Harlan County, you very rarely got the sense that people ever knew they were being filmed. And here you're always aware that they're always aware that they're being filmed. But it's 30 years later. And how many times have these people been filmed and been in front of the camera? And there's a certain spontaneity you're just not going to be able to capture. I think what is interesting that Koppel does, clearly she has a little bit of an agenda here to try to humanize the Dixie Chicks and to show the impact
absolutely
this had on them. And what she does, she goes out of her way to show them as women, as mothers.
Yep.
And I think her goal there clearly is to try to make maybe some of these people who were absolutely vilifying these people see that, you know, they're a good mom.
Yeah.
You know, so wait a second. Should you really hate this woman like the way you think you hate this woman? So I don't know. I did really like the film. I think a lot of it has to do with, you know, you're enough of a music snob that you would never admit to even liking the Dixie Chicks.
That's crazy, because, I mean, I think I admitted maybe subtly about how good these women are. I mean,
I think you were really
see
subtle.
Maines is just an incredible power.
I'm a music snob as well, a little different than you. My bands don't always have to be cool the way yours do. But for me, I've always...
They should be unpleasant to listen to. That's how I measure.
That's it. Yeah. I've always been one of those people who would not buy a Dixie Chicks album, but when the songs are on the radio, I think they're catchy as can be, and I do respect them. They're all talented players, and I said just actually the other day to you that Natalie Maines, I've always liked her because I love her voice, and I love how abrasive she is. I love that persona on stage of her just being this woman who just, she has that big voice and she just booms it out, you know, even when she's not singing. And I've always respected that about her. And you know, I think that if there's one thing Koppel misses in the film, and we'll just end here, is that I feel like she doesn't maybe explore enough this band dynamic of she really does say something that ruins their careers on a major level, affects the other people in the band. She ends up speaking for the Dixie Chicks and they end up coming to her defense, and they're with her this whole time, but the movie never really probes enough with those characters to get them alone and to really
see how they really feel.
Doesn't put them in an uncomfortable situation to let us know that. And then we get a great scene later where Marty McGuire, one of the two sisters, says, you know, if she came to me right now, I know that she still blames herself, and if she came to me right now and said, I can't do this anymore, I'm gonna quit the band, I'd give up my career that I love. And she's in tears for her. And that put a really interesting, then that answered my question in a way, but I wanted to know more.
It's funny that you brought that up because I thought that exact same thing. I appreciated the fact that Koppel didn't actually isolate them because I liked that just about every scene, the whole band was there. And I felt like, yeah, you could put them in the room. And I bet even whether it's in context or out of context, you could make it look like this person's really upset. You could create drama. But I loved what Koppel did was just, you know, they're at a radio station. Maines opens her mouth, and it's a little risky what she says, and it just pans to one of the other sisters. And she's got a look on her face like, careful, we've been down this road before. That honestly is enough for me. And I have to say, too, no, Maines may not be a Dylan, but every time she opens her mouth, there's drama, there's suspense.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, not unlike Dylan.
There is. And I do think, again, a lot of it may depend how much you enjoy this film, may depend on whether or not you enjoy the music, because it does sort of chronicle them making their next album and taking this artistic departure. I think the new music on the album's good and interesting. And so for me, that was interesting. Again, Shut Up and Sing, it opens in select cities October 27th, and it's going to get a wider release on November 10th. So look for it then.
Who could think of a better punishment, really? Everything's the same here, it's just a little worse. I've thought about suicide again, but I haven't tried it. I didn't want to end up in a bigger shithole than this one.
That's Patrick Fugit as Zia, speaking from and about the afterlife in Goran Dukic's debut film, Wrist Cutters, A Love Story. Dukic won the Best Director Prize at this year's Seattle Film Festival. I was thinking, one of the reasons that I go to film festivals, part of the idea that I like about film festivals is the hope that I will come across something completely original and imaginative and unexpected. And a lot of what you see, I think I can speak collectively, a lot of what we see at film festivals is not great. It's not surprising. It's not unique or special or any of these things that the directors hope it is. And honestly, that's totally understandable. And going to film festivals reminds me how hard it is to make a movie. It's hard. It requires a lot of people and their commitment and making it work. And I think you can agree with me.
Sure.
Here we have a movie with a title that seems honestly like perfect film fest bait. There's hundreds of movies playing. You don't know anything about any of them. You have no idea how to choose one. And you see a movie with the title Wrist Cutters, A Love Story. And you have to wonder, how could a movie like that live up to its title? Well, the plot, I can assure you, does live up to its title. It's about finding love in an afterlife populated entirely by suicides. But, Adam, apart from the plot, does the movie live up to its eye-catching title?
Well, it's interesting that you bring this up, Sam, because we're probably reviewing it because of its eye-catching title.
Probably, realistically, a good part of it.
Why did we see this film? Why did we pick it out? Because it sounded interesting. I mean,
I like
Patrick Fugit from Almost Famous, but still, it's because it sounded so compelling with the title and the plot. And how does it live up to its title? Not very well, unfortunately, for me. You're right. It is a great dark comic title, and the opening setup that we heard there in the clip is great. This concept of a purgatory for people who have committed suicide, great idea, should be very funny and dark and interesting. And I got to be honest, I just don't think I really laughed even once at this film. And the absurdity of it, obviously a very absurd premise, that didn't even work for me. It's like, hey, it's an indie road movie, so, you know, we have to get Tom Waits to come on and act really weird and eccentric. I got to be honest, I didn't get it.
Before people change the radio station here, I did love it, in fact.
Wow.
I really loved it. And again, it's flawed. I'm going to say that right now, particularly towards the end. It overreaches a little bit. It introduces these ideas, these really big concepts that it can't possibly resolve, God and fate.
And isn't really interested in resolving.
But most of this film, and again, I think I give extra credit to directors that are willing to attempt something like this and maybe even partially succeed. Stories that are original and imaginative and create a time and place that requires its own rules and obeys them, I think. I really enjoyed this movie start to finish. The movie, I love the suspense, the fun suspense of the first scene. And again, that's going to sound a little awful because the scene ends in somebody committing suicide by slitting their wrists. But you have the title. I mean, the title gives you so much information about what the experience is going to be like. And I loved that, you know, we have this scene, you know, this Tom Waits ballad is playing. There's a Patrick Fugit wakes up with this messy, messy room. And you think like, well, any minute, he's just going to slit his wrists. I love that the movie spends a minute and a half watching him clean his room while this Tom Waits dirge is playing. And I thought that set a tone for the entire film that really made
and
me
I thought
completely
it never
enjoy it.
Matched
I loved the design of it. I laughed out loud a lot.
Really?
I loved the cast. Patrick Fugit's great in a really difficult role.
He's fine.
Shannon Sossaman's great.
Yeah,
and
she's okay.
Shea Whigham as the Russian emigre ex-rocker is hysterical. I think Steve Zahn was like, where the hell was I when they cast this part? You know he would have been cast 5 years ago.
Yeah.
I'm so happy that we saw this film because if only one other person listening to this gets to see it, my job on Film Spotting will have been done.
Well, and people listening here to this show, here on Saturday night, Chicago Public Radio, it is playing, actually. Sam, do you have it in front of you? It has a couple more screenings here coming up at the Film Fest if you want to check it out. It is going to be released, I think, later in the year. It actually doesn't have currently a theatrical release date set, but if
but
you're here in
Chicago,
you want to see it, you can check it out.
That's right, Monday the 16th at 8:15 at Landmark Century Center Cinema. That's at Clark and Diversey. And then this Wednesday, the 18th, at 6:15 p.m. Downtown at the AMC River East at 322 East Illinois.
Okay.
So check
well,
it out.
Sam heartily recommends
really
it.
Do.
Can I have maybe just a last comment about it, Sam?
I don't
because
know why.
You
it's
raved
gonna be,
about it.
All right.
I just want to say that I think I found myself distracted, truly distracted the whole time thinking about those rules that you mentioned and what this life, if you can call it that, was really like and how it was different or similar to our lives. I think that's what you're doing throughout is going, okay, how is this really different than being alive?
Yeah.
But I don't think the movie really explored that in an interesting way. And, you know, on some level, it just didn't end up deep enough. I ended up thinking about that the whole time because the movie wasn't giving me any of that.
Any movie that had me singing over the credits, the song that was playing over the credits, a song I'd never heard before, obviously, because it was introduced in the film,
yeah,
is a film I heartily recommend.
With such a great title and a great concept, it really shouldn't have bored me to tears like it did.
God, I didn't stop laughing.
But I'm very happy for you, Sam.
All right, we're going to take another quick break. When we come back, more from the 42nd Annual Chicago International Film Festival as we have a conversation with actor-turned-director D.B. Sweeney, plus Massacre Theater, and later in the show, this week's Top 5, movies about starting over. Stay with us.
The champagne's still on ice. Might as well down it tonight. It ain't gonna last 4 more years, nor will your rise. It continues where it began. Drawing lines in the sand.
Hello again, podcast listeners. Time to announce this week's Massacre Theater winner. Last week, you heard Sam as James Bond and me playing Auric Goldfinger in a scene from the movie Goldfinger, a tie-in with our top five coolest characters. And the winner is Ben Waldorf from Santa Cruz, California. Congratulations, Ben. Email us at feedback@filmspotting.net, and we'll set you up with a DVD of your choice.
Welcome back to Film Spotting on Chicago Public Radio with Adam Kempinar. I'm Sam Van Halgren. We want to take a quick second to thank the Waco Brothers and Chicago's own Bloodshot Records for tonight's music. Great stuff, Adam, from their Freedom and Weep album.
Yes, great.
Yeah.
Falls right in line with our Dixie Chicks review earlier, actually.
But now, it's time for Massacre Theater, part of the show where we act out a scene from a movie and you try to identify what movie we're absolutely destroying.
That's exactly right. Identify the film and you'll be eligible to win the DVD of your choice. And Sam, since we first started this segment, we've been dying to get a true professional to help us out, come in, add some class to the proceedings.
As hard as we try every week.
Yeah, it doesn't work. But we want to see how it's done and how to become better actors. Now we have that chance because D.B. Sweeney is here in studio with us. You know him from Gardens of Stone, from Eight Men Out, from The Cutting Edge. D.B., thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. It's great to be here with you guys.
We're going to talk about your new film, Dirt Nap, here in a second, but first, are you up for a little acting?
I am ready.
Okay.
You know?
You've been directing for what? You've been shilling this movie for months and months?
It's been forever. I'm just ready to get back
on. You're feeling rusty? Do you want to warm up?
You know what? I'm going to do a little vocal thing.
Vocal exercises.
Yeah.
There we go.
Well, the only hint...
That's what we don't do. We got to do more warm-ups.
That's it. We don't.
Never do warm-ups.
That's what we're missing. The only hint we're going to give, as always, the Massacre Theater scene ties in with our top five topic, which is movies about starting over.
Yes.
And we'll get into that more specifically in the next segment in our top five. So, movies about starting over, that's all we're going to say, and that's probably all we should say in this case.
I think
before we get too clever for our own good.
Right.
So, okay, DB, you actually start the scene, so I'm going to give you the action. And action.
We're going to call it a day. See you tomorrow.
Okay.
Good night.
Hey, do you want to come with us?
You mean it?
No, not you. Him.
Him?
Come with you?
Out there.
What is out there?
Come and find out.
Wait a second. Why him? You wouldn't be here if it weren't for me.
I'm unattached. You have a family.
I want to know what's out there. I want to see it.
But you're not invited.
Not invited? What do you mean I'm not invited? I've done everything I've been asked to do. I didn't understand it, but I've done it, and I haven't once asked what's in it for me.
What are you saying?
I'm saying, what's in it for me?
Is that why you did this? For you?
And scene.
Adam, you've never been worse.
Oh, thank
never.
You.
I mean, I think it's the context.
It is.
But
yeah.
We've been shamed.
We have been shamed.
You even took the bulk of the lines.
I know. And I butchered it. It is embarrassing.
DB,
at the risk of sounding like a suck up, I thought you guys were stellar. I really did.
That's all we need to hear.
I thought that was tremendous.
Our heads are already so big.
Yeah.
You should have heard my Al Pacino a couple weeks ago.
It was great.
Outstanding.
It really was. Well, if you know what film the three of us just massacred, or at least two of us massacred, send an email
all
to
three.
feedback@filmspotting.net. The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on the Film Spotting podcast on Wednesday, October 25th. To listen in to get complete Massacre Theater rules, just go to filmspotting.net. And we are here, of course. It is the Chicago International Film Festival. And DB, you have your first writing and directing debut here, Dirt Nap. We wanted to ask you about that. You just actually came from a screening. How did it go?
You know, I felt like such a butt kisser talking to the audience after, but you know, playing in front of Chicago, this is one of my favorite towns, and I was very excited. You know, I've played it about 25 times now, all over Europe and America, and this was one of the best audiences. You know, it was like the theater wasn't like packed to the gills or anything like that. It was just that everybody that was there was just, I don't know, into the movie. And it's really gratifying when you go through all that effort and then you hear people hearing it the first time and laughing or being affected by it. So I had a good time tonight.
For our listeners out there, how do you describe the movie? When people ask you what your film is about, what do you say?
It's about three guys from a small Pennsylvania town who, when they were 20 years old, they were hot stuff. The quarterback of the football team, the valedictorian, and the rock and roller. And now on the verge of 40, they're completely and thoroughly mediocre. And they're bewildered by how mediocre they've become. And I think that's where the comedy comes from, is that they can't understand how they fell so far.
And what inspired this for you? When did you first kind of have the germ of this idea?
Around the turn of the millennium, I was sort of looking over the roles I was getting offered. And I thought, you know, everybody always gives me the part of the intense guy or the serious guy. And I thought most of my friends, they think I'm a goofball, or at least that I'm kind of funny. And so I thought, well, how am I ever going to get to play the funny guy? And I thought, well, I'm going to have to write it. So I got together with my friend Brian Curry, and we wrote the script. And then when we started thinking about who we're making the movie for, because we thought it was important to have a sense of that, it was for, you know, the people approaching 40 who maybe haven't had everything they want in life. And a lot of the people I grew up with became, you know, I grew up in Long Island, and people became firemen and policemen and teachers. And none of them go to the movies anymore because they feel like the movies gave up on them. So I wanted to make a movie, maybe, you know, not that it excludes anybody who's, you know, younger, because I think if you're 20 years old, you know these three guys. It's either your uncle or your older brother, or, you know these guys. And I think that everybody has been around these sort of types. And so that was the initial genesis of it.
Going from, what, 20 years as an actor, moving into the director's seat, what did you learn, and what was a little bit different than what you'd expected?
Well, the hardest part for me was, I didn't plan to direct it and I didn't plan to produce it. I actually tried to get the usual Hollywood sources to finance it, and they all sort of said, well, if you get so-and-so to play this part and so-and-so to play that part, and maybe you could stay home, we'll give you the money. And I thought, well, that would kind of defeat the purpose, wouldn't it? Or they would, they just had different ideas about it. So eventually I decided I'm going to have to finance it myself. So I took out these loans, and, and my financial life is hanging in the balance as we speak. But I'm glad I did it. I felt like I couldn't bear turning 70 someday and thinking, God, you should have took a shot. You should have done that. So I did it. And the directing part of it was also not part of my plan. But when I started to look at the candidates who were willing to do it and who we could afford, I thought, well, I could wreck it as well as they could. So I thought, may as well just do that too. So I wasn't really out to do that sort of like whole auteur ego trip, that I have to show everybody how creative I am and how many hats I can wear. I would have loved to just write it and play the part and have it be directed by, I don't know, Ron Shelton or some great comedy director. That would have been great. But that wasn't the way it shook out. So I'm proud of what happened. And it was a big lesson in terms of when you set yourself, I guess that's, it's a little bit of a cliche, but that's why people climb mountains. I mean, it's like, all right, I'm gonna see if I can do it. And so part of it was, can I meet this challenge? And I'm proud of the fact that I feel like I did meet most of the things that I was required to do.
So you've worked with some great directors in your time, John Sayles, of course, Francis Ford Coppola. Is there anything that you approached this that you knew you'd try to emulate, or that you'd try to do what they didn't do?
Yeah, it's very astute of you to pull those two guys out, because I think those are probably the two best directors that I've ever worked with. And the one thing that they both did, and maybe it comes from having directed The Godfather or Matewan and all these great movies, obviously those guys are behind, it gives you the confidence not to have to prove that you're the director every day. And I felt like a lot of first-time directors I work with, or even second-time, third-time directors, it's sort of like their image of directing is that the famous photo of David Lean in front of the Klieg lights pointing at the, into the wind, mm-hmm. and just sort of playing the role of the director that, and moving the cavalry around and just shouting out orders and everything. And John and Francis, what they had in common was that they knew they were the director, and they had hired the best people in every area, and they didn't feel like they had to prove they were the director every day, that the proof was going to be in the pudding. And I took a lot from that. I felt like, and I remember one time Francis said to me, he came over the scene, obviously, I don't remember which scene it was, but it wasn't working. And he came over and he said, okay. And then he took a pause and he looked at me. He was nodding and thinking and scratching his beard and rubbing his substantial belly. And then he said, let's do another one. And what he didn't say in that moment he spent with me while everybody else was, 120 people worried about the sun going down or the clock ticking or the money running down the drain or whatever they were worried about, he was giving me a moment to say, look, I don't know the answer, and maybe you don't know the answer, but we'll figure it out, and I'm with you. And I thought that the subtext of that is what a director can give to an actor. That's the best gift you can give an actor is, I trust you that you're going to figure it out, and maybe we'll do another one, and I'll think of something, or not. But we're in this together. And so many directors, there's this idea that I have to get the performance out of the actor. And that's the worst myth of all time, because it's not, if a kid swallows a nickel, you get the nickel out of the kid, by doing the Heimlich maneuver. But you don't, you don't get a performance. It's more like, I think a better analogy would be to be like a snake charmer, that you try to create the atmosphere for the, for the performance to give itself up.
Yeah, they always say you try to get the performance you want by making them think that they came up with it rather than kind of forcing them into it.
I think that sometimes you do have to use that. That's a little on the manipulative side, but it's sometimes the sun's going down, you have to do it. But I think that ultimately everybody comes to the set not wanting to suck, from the guy making the coffee to the actors to the hair people. And so once you realize that, everybody wants to do well. So as a director, your job, I think, is to create the conditions under which everybody can produce the thing which they are capable of offering. And once you trust that they're gonna do it, and you don't have to do it, I think it's very liberating.
Well, we can relate. That's pretty much our only ambition here on Film Spotting, is to not suck week in and
week
out.
Week in, week out.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if we've accomplished
it or
not.
Shoot for mediocrity. You were talking about ending up in mediocrity. We shoot for mediocrity.
There you go. You're listening to Film Spotting on Chicago Public Radio, and we have D.B. Sweeney with us, actor, writer, director. His film Dirt Nap is playing here at the Chicago Film Festival. What did you learn about yourself as an actor, if anything, being behind the camera, and do you have any plans to do it again?
I don't think I will play as big a part in a movie that I direct ever again, because that was a very insecure part of it. I mean, I'm not an insecure actor. I know that I have certain abilities, certain strengths, certain weaknesses, and I'm very confident on a set, that, you know, to the extent that, you know, I've gotten comfortable in a role. Obviously, on the first day, I think if you're not scared or nervous or concerned if it's the right thing to do, then I think you've taken a part that you've done too many times. So there is always some anxiety and some fear to do well as an actor. But when you're directing yourself, you really have to trust that you're going to have your instincts are going to be in line every day. And so what I said was to my camera operator, I said, look, I don't want you to direct me. And my friend John McGinley was playing opposite me, and I didn't want him to direct me, even though they're both, Claudio Rocca, the DP, had made 30 movies. John had made 80 or whatever. I don't want you guys to direct me. But at the end of a take, when it's on me, I'm going to say to you guys subtly, so none of the crew sees, thumbs up or thumbs down. And I meant, and don't tell me that it was good or bad. Just say, do you need another one? Do you have it or do you need another one? And if either of them said, do another one, I just did another one without comment, without prejudice. And sometimes I would do three more because I thought if they feel strongly enough to say you might not have it, I just would go again. So I did more takes with me sometimes than other actors because I knew I was going to need more things to do, more choices in the editing room.
You brought up McGinley. I mean, he's one of our favorite that guy kind of actors. Like you said, you mentioned he had to be in about 80 movies just in the 80s, I think, in early 90s.
I always remember him as O'Neill from Platoon. I'll forever think of him as...
I am so effing short.
Yeah, Tom Berenger's whipping boy in Platoon.
Yeah. So can you talk a little bit about the cast specifically? I think, you know, I was trying to think of a way to describe McGinley's persona on screen, and he's just like this kind of, always comes across as this kind of arrogant, bullish, bully kind of guy, but you like him. You like spending time with him.
Well, it was very important. John's one of my oldest friends. We went to NYU together. He was in the master's program, and I was in the undergraduate program, so he's actually significantly older than me. But he's one of my oldest friends, and we met at a bar on 14th Street watching Monday Night Football, and we watched about five straight Monday Night Football games together and had a few beers, and I think I was drinking a non-alcoholic beverage.
Uh-huh, of course.
Might have been a glass of milk. Uh-huh. I can't remember what it was, but mm-hmm. he was like blitzed on Jack Daniels and Coke. I don't know. But anyway, that's beside the way. So we sat there for about five straight weeks, and finally I was kind of embarrassed. I'm studying acting. It's sort of like saying, you know, I'm in dance school or something. I don't know what it was. You know. And so I said, I'm studying acting at NYU. He goes, me too. And we both were so relieved that, you know, that the other guy didn't get up and take his beer across the room and sit with the fireman. So that was a long time ago. And I thought, when I direct my first movie, I want to make sure that I'm going to have a guy who's not going to play out a lot of the psychodramas that take place between actors and directors just because people are used to doing that. And John is one of my closest friends, and I trusted him with the part. And I also thought, he's always the sidekick, the guy on the right, the guy making somebody else look good. Mm-hmm. And I thought, how great would it be in my first movie to take a real character guy and make him the leading man and have that work and have people see him after 25 years for the first time? So that was sort of my grand ambition in casting him.
Yeah, he's great. He's a lot of fun to watch. So if people want to learn more about your movie and possibly where they can see it, how do they get that information?
Well, we have a website. It's called dirtnapmovie.com, dirtnapmovie.com. And there they can see the trailer for the movie. Or they can go on YouTube and put in Dirtnap plus trailer. Or they can go to Internet Movie Database and put in Dirtnap on the search bar. And, you know, any of those places, if they like what they see, if they want to give us a nice rating, that's all good. But the movie's probably going to be out in the spring. And I mention all those websites because there's a good chance we're going to change the title. The distributor's not crazy about the title, which I understand. And I think people, when they see the movie, they'll understand. Dirtnap sounds kind of like a gangster movie, and it's really
not
like
as much
a friend's,
of a comedy. Yeah,
it's a comedy. And so some of the names are kicking
about
around.
Dirt Nappy Time.
Dirt Nappy
that's
Time?
That's funny. That's fun.
Don't let Sam
get involved. I like it.
Involved.
Oh, I like
I've got
it.
A lot of bad ideas. Stay here all night.
Hang on, I'm scribbling. and also we're going to play at the Savannah Film Festival the first week of November in Kookaloris, which is Wilmington, North Carolina. And that's, I think, the end of the festivals because I think we are moving into a distribution mode now. And I've learned a lot from the festivals, and it's been great to get out there. But, you know, it's time to grow up now and go out there and charge.
Okay, well, before we let you go, we have to get your thoughts on our top five movies about starting over. Your film really ties in with that. Three guys who are looking for a new lease on life and trying to do something new. So what are some movies for you that come to mind when you think of your favorite movies that deal with that?
Well, I mean, I think it's a great topic, first of all, because I think it is one of the, you know, the enduring problems that you never get tired of watching in a movie. Somebody who's, you know, who's wherever they are, they decide, you know what, I got to change fields here. So in honor of your show, the first one that popped in was Trainspotting. And it's one of the all-time screw your friends over movies.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just a tremendous movie all around. I mean, I actually...
Is it going to ruin the ending for everybody?
Yeah. Absolutely. Every chance I get.
No, it's all right.
Yeah. By the way, the crying game, it's a guy. Oh, sorry.
You heard it here last.
Sorry.
Yeah.
And I love, you know, Hoosiers is a great movie for that. You know, I mean, you got everybody sort of like is, you know, is at the end of their rope and needs a shot. And, you know, and that's, plus it's just one of my favorite movies.
Yeah.
And this one's a little bit out of left field or out of the ocean, I guess. But Breaking the Waves, I mean, you know, it's not the first thing I think of when things are going bad is to go out on a boat and bang everybody. But it is certainly a change of direction.
Yes.
And I thought it was a brilliant movie, and it was before Lars Von Trier became a complete moron and decided you had to make movies in theaters.
In the dark and on stages. And
don't have any special effects. Right. And all the other rules.
You mean movie making?
Yeah. It's like, you know, I mean, if I wanted a bunch of rules, I'd go work on Wall Street.
Right.
So, or in the commodities market.
Right. McKinley haunts us.
Yeah.
And then I love Kramer versus Kramer.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I mean, I thought I think it was maybe the best Dustin Hoffman movie, if not, well, Ratso Rizzo in that one. But Ratso Rizzo, I know, isn't a movie. Don't write.
We got it. Midnight Cowboy.
Yeah. And then I have to, my all-time favorite actor, Robert Duvall, Tender Mercies, you know, as Max Sledge. You know, that's just, to me, that was a clinic. And I'm always going to be grateful to him for all he taught me when we did Lonesome Dove together. So that would be my five.
All right. Great list. There are certainly some films that have come up a lot here on our show. And once again, we really appreciate your time. Best of luck with the movie.
Thank you so much for having me. It was really fun.
Great. All right. Well, we're going to take one more quick break. And when we come back, we will get into our top five movies about starting over. Stay with us. Listening to Film Spotting on Chicago Public Radio with Sam Van Halgren. I'm Adam Kempinar, and it is top five time. We had a chance to hear some of D.B. Sweeney's choices here in the last segment. Great to have him on.
Tender Mercies, great pick.
Yeah, definitely some great picks in there. But it is time for our top five movies about starting over. And Sam, I was having a tough time with this list earlier in the week. And I emailed you and I said, give me some guidance here. Kind of what are you
Make
using?
Make my list for me.
Literally. Give me your guiding criterion. Give me something so that I can form my list. And you had a really nice sentence that helped me.
Let's see if I can recreate it. Essentially, it was somebody is headed in a very specific direction and then they decide to change course.
Okay.
And I think that's a matter of whether it's reinventing yourself or if it's just making a decision about your life and it's all of a sudden it's completely different.
Yeah, and in fact, the way you phrased it, I have it here in front of me.
Oh, good.
Words of gold.
You're
said
quizzing me.
People who were living one life through some decision on their own or through some outside force change the direction of their life.
Right.
So there you go.
Better in print. Much more articulate
you are.
In print.
You are much better in print. And it's also, of course, a topic that we didn't just pull out of the thin air. All of the movies, as you've heard throughout the show, relate to this topic.
Uncanny.
The Dixie Chicks, Guide to Recognizing Your Saints, people having to embrace their old life or their new life and going in a new direction.
Yeah, risk cutters
as
sure.
well. So it's been a
and
topic.
And Dirt Nap, of course, like
and
you
Dirt
said.
Nap. Yeah. Yes. Okay. So with that in mind,
yes.
it is time for the top five. Sam, your number five.
My number five, the kind of film you would expect to see at a film festival. And I put it at number five in honor of the Chicago International Film Festival. It is The Man Without a Past, Aki Kaurismäki, Finnish director, a movie about a man who, at the very beginning of the film, and actually it made me think, in very, very similar in spirit and tone to Wrist Cutters, A Love Story, a man gets brutally beaten at the beginning of the film, winds up in the hospital, he's declared dead on the scene, and then we see him emerge from his bed, walk away on his own volition, set up camp in a trailer and by the river. And the life he leads from then on, he may or may not be real in some way. He finds love in some way. He finds friendship. And you realize that the life he's living now, whether he's dead or not, is better than the one he used to. So anyway.
Interesting choice.
Good
Very
pick.
Interesting.
Something
and I am sticking with the foreign theme here, Sam. I have a tie. My number five is a tie. Old Boy and Lady Vengeance.
Hold on.
Both films from Park Chan-wook.
Yeah.
The second and third installments in his revenge trilogy. Old Boy was one of our favorite films from last year. I believe we both had it in our top five. And Lady Vengeance, for me, is among my favorite films so far this year. Both involve characters being released from prisons, literally in Lady Vengeance. In Old Boy, it's more of a... Well, it's still a prison.
It's
He's
a prison.
Being held captive. It's just not part of any kind of judicial system.
And outside the law, yeah.
These are characters who come out of these prisons very different people than they were going in.
With one thing on their mind.
With one thing on their mind, yeah. Revenge. But they both have to deal with their new lives and who they are now, but they very much have to deal with their past as well. Love the performances in both films of the lead actors, and I also love Park Chan-wook's just poetic visual style.
Absolutely.
It's really amazing, very intense. That's my number five.
Good pick. My number four, I've got a tie here, and it's a tie, a thematic tie, starting over because you have Amnesia. I've got Hal Hartley's Amateur with Martin Donovan as Thomas Ludens, wakes up with amnesia, and through the course of the film learns that he may have been a very, very, very bad man indeed before his case of amnesia.
Nice. And the tie is regarding Henry.
No, even better, The Bourne Identity.
Oh.
Doug Liman. I'm not going to get into The Bourne Identity, but I really recommend that you see Amateur. I love The Bourne Identity. That's why it's in my top five, and it's certainly a case of somebody starting over from scratch and learning that they were a very bad, bad man for the government.
Sure.
But Hal Hartley, if you haven't seen a Hal Hartley film, it was my first Hal Hartley film, and sort of entered the bizarro world, deadpan bizarro world of Hal Hartley, a great film.
Okay, and a great choice. There are great choices. My number four, we heard D.B. Sweeney talk a little bit about getting the chance to work with him on the film Eight Men Out and John Sayles. My number four choice here is Passion Fish, 1992 film starring Mary McDonnell, and really a brilliant Oscar-nominated performance. She's a soap opera star, Mae Alice, who gets into an accident and is then bound to a wheelchair and is really not that happy about it, moves back to Louisiana, and she's basically just a drunk and someone who's upset with life and the way things have turned out for her, and she keeps dismissing her nurses who don't want to work with her, don't want to help her anymore, and she has a new one, Chantel, played by Alfre Woodard, also a great role, great performance, and they end up, of course, kind of forming a friendship and renewing each other in some way and helping each other come to new points in their life and moving on from there. And, of course, always nice to see a Sayles regular, David Strathern, in there as a love interest as well. So great film. Alfre Woodard should have been nominated, and she wasn't. I believe Sayles was actually also nominated for Best Screenplay that year. So
right.
Passion Fish.
Good pick. Number three, another tie. I haven't done ties in a while. I thought it was time.
So you're getting them all in now.
Getting them all in now. Two movies about criminals that start over with a new identity. My favorite film from last year, as it was yours, A History of Violence, and one of my favorite films from this year, although not yours, Down in the Valley, directed by David Jacobson. You've got Edward Norton as Harlan, a possibly delusional, possibly dangerous criminal who reinvents himself as a 19th century cowboy in modern day L.A. The absurdity is just making you cringe.
I can see it. Yeah.
And then, of course, you've got Viggo Mortensen as Tom Stahl, a man who may or may not have been or may or may not have had a very, very violent past, trying to reinvent himself as the perfect small town American family man.
Okay, well, I can certainly compliment one of those choices, but I'm not going to touch Down in the Valley anymore. My number three choice, I've got P.T. Anderson's debut film, Hard Eight, as it's known now, Sydney, his debut film from 1996. John C. Reilly plays a character named John, one of our favorite actors. We see him at the very beginning of the film, sitting penniless outside a diner, just looks beaten by the world. Philip Baker Hall comes along and becomes a father figure to him and someone who gives him a new lease on life as a small-time gambler in Reno. And great performances all around in this film, of course, from Riley and Philip Baker Hall. Sam Jackson's in it as well. But Gwyneth Paltrow has kind of a small role in it as a waitress slash hooker named Clementine, who John C. Riley gets mixed up with and messed up with. Right. And I really think that was the performance for me, actually, of hers that I said, you know what, she can really act. I really like Gwyneth Paltrow, and she's great in this film. So if you're one of those people who liked Magnolia, liked Boogie Nights, liked Punch Drunk Love, but have never gone back and seen Heart 8 or Sydney, you really need to go see what P.T. Anderson can do on a smaller scale.
Really good. It's a great pick. All right, my number two, we were just talking about Michel Gondry. Last week, Science Asleep, my number two is his previous film, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. You have here two ex-lovers, Jim Carrey, Kate Winslet, trying to erase each other from each other's minds before possibly, at the end, maybe giving it another try, starting over. But certainly, you know, you're starting with a blank mind. You're erasing a relationship. Certainly a great desire of some people. Fantastic film that I feel like doesn't fall into enough categories. We do these top fives all the time.
Right.
A favorite film of ours, or certainly a film we really, really admire. And some films don't fit very neatly into categories, and I was glad to put it on here.
Just about every Gondry film is that way.
Yeah.
So great choice. My number two, you had it on your list in a tie here, but it is A History of Violence, much to the chagrin of some of our listeners who just didn't quite get it the way we did. They didn't enjoy it on the level that we did.
And we spent the whole last third of last year talking about it.
They were sick of us talking about it, but it was our favorite film of 2005. David Cronenberg, always a director I've liked, but really, this might be my favorite film of his. And of course, you said it, you have a guy starting over literally by having to accept and on some level even embrace possibly his former self and a life he's given up. And again, you know, Cronenberg style isn't for everyone, but we loved it. And once again, like all the movies here in my top five, great performances. Viggo Mortensen, I thought, was one of the best of the year. Maria Bello, we thought, certainly got snubbed at Oscar time. And Ed Harris, too, always good. Fascinating here. So History of Violence, my number two.
Great pick. All right, my number one on the podcast, we just finished a 6-week screwball comedy marathon, one of my favorites, if not my favorite, Gregory LaCava's My Man Godfrey, with William Powell as Godfrey, rich man termed idealistic bum turned butler turned reemerged rich man, rich emotionally, rich financially. And just one of those great discoveries, not only William Powell, who we had seen in The Thin Man, of course, an amazing performance, but the film that is just incredibly, incredibly funny. And William Powell's performance of this man who's starting over again and again, I think just holds the whole thing together.
Yeah.
Really worth tracking down.
William Powell is fantastic. And even though I didn't enjoy My Man Godfrey as much as you did, I respect that choice a lot, and really, I can't quibble with it being your number one. It's certainly a film I overlooked because he's absolutely a guy. Reinvents himself multiple times, as you said. It's a great choice, and I considered one also from our Screwball Comedies Marathon, Sullivan's Travels. You have a director trying to go in a brand new direction, and we see where it gets him, into some trouble, but it's a great film, Preston Sturgis, so another one we'll just kind of throw in there. Which brings me to my number one, and this unfortunately isn't as suspenseful as I would have hoped, Sam, because you once again stole my number one, but it is actually The Bourne Identity. This is a film.
Nice.
Yes, we both really like this film. I think it is easily the best action movie I've seen in the last 5 years. Starts with a character who is floating in the water, you know, full of bullets. And
it's time to start over.
Yeah, he has to piece together his identity and escape the people who are after him, become somebody brand new, discover who he really is and wants to be. And Doug Liman, great directing job here. Love the toned down spy movie, character driven spy movie. Again, great performances. Damon, Franca Potenta, Brian Cox, Chris Cooper, Clive Owen. I love the fact that you have an action movie that really ends where, or at least where the big set piece, action piece, is the shootout between him and Clive Owen, and it's so understated and
so
small
quiet.
And quiet. And that really is kind of, for me, I think, even more than what we get after that, the big climax of the movie in a way, and it's so small, we just aren't used to seeing that in Hollywood films, and I love it. So,
I mean, Clive Owen's performance in that is virtually that scene, really. And going back to see it, I was surprised to see how small that role is. It leaves an incredible impression. Of course, we love Clive Owen anyway, but that's...
We do.
That's an amazing performance in terms of what he does with so little. All right, well, that is our top five. Please send your top five or any other feedback to feedback@filmspotting.net or give us a call at 206-203-2463 and leave a message. We'll be back on Saturday, October 28th at 8 p.m. with another top five and more reviews of new movies right here on Chicago Public Radio. In the meantime, go to filmspotting.net to listen to the weekly Film Spotting podcast.
You can check out the Film Spotting blog at filmspotting.net for complete show archives, a calendar of upcoming reviews, and more. And also on the Film Spotting blog, sign up for the Dope Sheet, our weekly email blast. This radio edition of Film Spotting is presented by Chicago Public Radio with production and editorial assistance from Christina Stevens and Joe Dassault. Our thanks to the Waco Brothers and Bloodshot Records for tonight's music. More information is available at bloodshotrecords.com. We'd also like to thank the Chicago International Film Festival and especially Masha Alexander in the Media Relations Office. For Film Spotting, I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Sam Van Hallgren. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is presented by PeerFlix. Trade DVDs online at peerflix.com/filmspotting.